So the first reading is Isaiah, and it's Isaiah chapter 11, page 661, if you have a church Bible. And we're going to be reading the first nine verses of Isaiah 11. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of might, the Spirit of the knowledge and fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes, or decide what he hears with his ears. But with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. With the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt, and faithfulness the sash round his waist. The wolf will live with the lamb. The leopard will lie down with the goat, the calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear. Their young will lie down together. The lion will eat straw like the ox. Infants will play near the den or the hole of the cobra. Young children will put their hands into the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Our second reading is in Matthew's Gospel. And it is here, chapter 12, and we're going to read verses 9 to 12. And again, if you have a church Bible, this is page 924. Sorry, I've written that down wrong, haven't I? No, I haven't. Okay. Yes, verses 9 to 21, sorry. Going from that place, he went into their synagogue. And a man with a shriveled hand was there. Looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, they asked him, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" He said to them, "If any of you has a sheep and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will you not take hold of it and lift it out? How much more valuable is a human being than a sheep? Therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath." Then he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." So he stretched it out, and it was completely restored, just as sound as the other. But the Pharisees went out and plotted how they might kill him. Aware of this, Jesus withdrew from that place. A large crowd followed him, and he healed all who were ill. He warned them not to tell others about him. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. "Here is my servant whom I have chosen, the one I love, in whom I delight. I will put my spirit on him, and he will proclaim justice to the nations. He will not quarrel or cry out. No one will hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed will he not break, and a smoldering wick he will not snuff out, till he leads justice to victory. In his name, the nations will put their hope." Let's remind ourselves, this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Just pray for Pete.
Good morning. So four widows were sitting playing cards in a sheltered housing complex when a very distinguished silver-haired gentleman, not you, arrived with carrying a suitcase. One of the women looked up and greeted him. "Oh, hi, what's happening?" "I'm moving in," he said. "Oh, where have you been living up till now?" "Well, I've been in prison for the last 15 years. "What did you do?" they asked. "Oh, I murdered my wife and buried her body under the patio." There was a long pause. And then one of the women looked up and said brightly, "Oh, so you're single." The passage today is about hope. Hope for the future. This passage in Isaiah starts in a very different place. It starts when it appears that all hope is lost. The Assyrians are on the borders. They're a world-conquering power. They're threatening to invade. And their usual routine is to conquer, to go in and take the land, to steal whatever they want, to carry off the people into slavery, and to destroy everything else. Sometimes the crops were burned, and even the trees were cut down, the wood carried off, and just a stump left where the tree had been. And the result of that death and destruction meant that the land, which had been fertile, cultivated, fruitful, returned to wasteland and desert. In a few short days, everything that the people had built in town and country, in home and garden, was destroyed. People killed, lives turned upside down. Maybe you've not been in that kind of environment, but I wonder whether you've been in a time when you've felt your life threatened. Everything that you've built, everything that you worked for over many years seems to be threatened with being taken away. Everything that you've constructed in home and garden, in work, in your life, seemingly overrun by destructive forces over which you have no control. This kind of experience can leave us feeling helpless, can leave us feeling hopeless. It makes us want to give up. If it's really bad and goes on for a long time, then it can be easier to give up hope than to try and keep that flame burning. It can be easier to accept unemployment than face the disappointment of a failed job interview. Easier, perhaps, than to remain single than be rejected again. Easier to let the weeds grow rather than plant the bulbs. And into this kind of context, into this kind of hopeless situation, Isaiah brings hope. He says the tree stump, cut off close to the ground, seemingly lifeless, will sprout. Everything will change. The central hope of Isaiah 11 is that one day things will be different. Things will not be as they are now. It's a bit like a man going to the doctors and being given a diagnosis of a terminal disease. As a scientist, he knows the disease will reliably run its course and deliver him step by relentless step to death's door. But what if he meets Jesus? And what if he hears that God can do miracles? And sometimes something different can happen. Sometimes people are healed. Maybe he will die anyway. But there is just a shaving of a possibility that heaven might break into his life and he might be healed. This improbable, unlikely hope is a wonderful thing, but unsettling. It disturbs the predictable certainty of that deterministic universe. A disturbing hope. Of course, excuse me, the problem with dreams is that the details don't often neatly correspond with the realities. If you read Isaiah chapter 11 and verse 4, for example, it suggests that the coming Messiah will have a degree in law and a career in the courts, rather than an apprenticeship in joinery and a career as a life coach, as a healer. The dream disturbs the old order with new possibilities, not with a new determinism. The terminally ill man is not, I'm sorry, guaranteed a miracle. Instead, he's given a disturbing and unsettling hope, a possibility, a shard of eternity placed in his heart. In Isaiah chapter 11, verses 6 to 9, the basic rules of creation seem to change. It says that the wolf will live peaceably with the lamb, hunter and prey living together in peace. Life in the natural order of creation seeming to run without bloodshed, and even a child is in charge. This is surely fiction or poetry or nonsense. The ramblings of a mad prophet, perhaps. Yet, doesn't it call to our hearts this kind of dream of a new world? Almost as if God places these kinds of visions in our hearts, we warm to these kinds of possibilities, as if we were made to dream, as if they lift us up and put us on the edge of our seats, leaving us dissatisfied with the status quo, disturbing our stuck lives, unsettling us with a disturbing hope. Every generation has been influenced by its dreamers. People who, when faced with an impossible dream, stand with Bertrand Russell, who, when faced with people saying why, said, why not? These people who refuse to accept the natural order of things, who chase after a dream. Kings ruled until Solon dreamed up democracy in ancient Athens. Slavery seemed natural until Wilberforce dreamed of another way. The scientists seemed to have control of knowledge until Tim Biel dreamed up the internet. Our human ability to imagine an alternative is the very foundation of scientific inquiry. It's the foundation of social reform. It's the foundation of every kind of art. There's something inside us that stretches forward, that reaches for the dream. In this passage, Isaiah is giving the people a dream, a shadowy image of a different kind of world. How do they respond? How do we respond? How can one respond from this? First, I need to take aside a moment and distinguish these kinds of dreams from fantasy. We sometimes get lost in fantasy. People get lost in a fantasy world, escaping from reality. A world of fantasy populated by fictional people driven by addiction or drugs, stepped into through computer games or slot machines, fantasy that robs people of their lives as they gaze into the pool like Narcissus, or spend hours looking into the mirror of Erised like Harry Potter. Hours slip by while people just sit, imprisoned in a glamorous fantasy world, preoccupied but unproductive. Fantasy robs people of their lives. In contrast, true dreams are as substantial and solid as a moving railway engine. True dream power drives the engine forward, wheels turning, rods pumping back and forth, unstoppable. In Nottingham, Jesse Boot dreamed of improved health for the people of the city, and down the track created Boots the Chemist. William Booth in Nottingham dreamed of a second chance for homeless people, and down the track formed the Salvation Army. In Nottingham in our own day, Karen Rooms and George Gabriel dreamed of a city where people work together for the greater good of the city, and down the track they created Nottingham Citizens. Substantial dreams. Isaiah chapter 11 is packed with dreams. And like our dreams at night time, the details are sometimes a bit confusing. But the message to our hearts is clear. Wide-ranging, ambitious, unsettling, energizing. Let's check out Isaiah's dream. Look at Isaiah 11, 6 to 9. The dream here is of a renewed creation. It's about taming the violence of the natural world. It's about renewing the relationship between humanity and the planet. The Bible, you know, teaches that the whole world order was knocked out of joint when Adam and Eve sinned in the Garden of Eden. And it will continue to strain and to pull and to crack until God puts it straight at the end of time. And something in us too cries out in pain whenever we hear of disasters in the natural world, of earthquakes and floods and mudslides, when we hear of the hurt and destruction that these things cause. Our hearts cry out in pain. We ache for that new order. We humans carry this future hope in our hearts for the renewal of creation. It shows up whenever we plant a garden. It shows up when we care for our pets. It shows up when we try and guess tomorrow's weather. We long for a renewed creation. We're disturbed by hope, unsettled by hope. And then verses 10 to 13 of Isaiah 11. Not just renewed creation, but renewed relationships. These verses point us to international relationships, to the bringing back of the refugees, to nation after nation after nation that has been the oppressor, giving up the slaves, the economic migrants, the oppressed peoples. In every generation, our world has been shattered by warmongers in foreign lands, by oppressors, people that leer over national boundaries and fill our sleep with nightmares. International conflict. And we hope for a new world. But it's not just out there, conflict between the nations. Verse 13 talks of conflict between tribes, jealousy and hostility between relatives. Do these things grieve you when you see them? Does Did your heart turn over in grief and sadness when we prayed for South Sudan and the conflict? Did your hearts go out for those children abducted and taken off into the bush? When conflict takes place in our world, maybe you saw the One Show the other night and the piece about grandparents being denied contact with their grandchildren. Anybody see that? One or two? Conflict in families, when families fall out. Something in us cries out in pain. And we humans carry this future hope in our hearts for that renewal of relationship. We don't just lie down and accept the status quo of fractured families, of prejudice and hate between ethnic groups. This unsettling hope for a better world shows up when we pray for peace, when we greet a stranger, when we learn a foreign language. It shows up, those actions of hope, when we forgive our family member, when we step out from the brokenness of a spoiled relationship and risk a new one. Remarriage is a declaration of hope over despair. We long for renewed relationships. We're disturbed by hope. Verses 6 to 9, a renewed creation. Verses 10 to 13, renewed relationships. And maybe I'm stretching and pushing the scripture a little bit, but verse 14 speaks to me of a renewed mind. You see, the situation was this. As the people face the prospect of being overrun by a superpower, an aggressive superpower with a reputation for death and destruction, their present and their future was filled with fear and anxiety. What did they do? They looked back to the past. They remembered a moment in their history when things had been glorious. They remembered the moment of crossing the Red Sea when they were threatened with destruction by the Egyptian powers coming to reclaim them and take them back into captivity, when they were surrounded on all sides and the wind blew and the sea parted and they walked through to freedom and the enemy took a bath. This moment of triumph, of victory over despair. And the prophet takes this glorious moment in their history and picks it up and replants it into their future, reframes it into a new political context, into a new circumstance. It's a different river. It's a different superpower. It's a different situation. But the same moment of glory taken from their past, the best of the past, transplanted into the future to give them a renewed hope, to give them, in place of anxiety and despair, a renewed mind. The future is transformed. Their minds are set at ease. And we too, in our day, have a problem with troubled minds. And isn't it true that you might go home to a beautiful house, you might have a wonderful network of friends or a lovely family, success around you, and if this is wrong, nothing is sweet. And many of us have been there, haven't we? And we need a renewed mind. Professor Whiteford published in The Lancet just a few months ago an amazingly complicated calculation where they looked at the burden of disease on the world. And the biggest cause of disability worldwide, the biggest cause was mental disorder. It's a big issue, isn't it? And we need not just a renewed creation, hope for a new relationship with our world. We don't just need new relationships. We need a renewed mind. And something in us cries out in pain whenever we meet people whose mental distress causes hurt or destruction to themselves or to others. But we humans carry hope for the renewal of minds. It shows up when we reassure a tearful child. It shows up when we hold a patient's frightened hand. It shows up when we go out for a meal and thank the waiter and praise the chef. It shows up when we believe and hope that the offender can change their ways, the sex worker can settle down, the drunken student can mature, the homeless person can rest in safety. We long for that kind of hope. We're disturbed and unsettled by the possibility of a different way. Do you have these longings in your heart? Do you lean in towards this improbable future? This unlikely but motivating dream of a renewed creation, of a renewed relationships, of a renewed mind. Is this dream set in you? These dreams are unsettling, disturbing, but energizing. They're fuel, they're like dream power that drives the engine down the track towards this future hope. But some of us have forgotten our dreams or swapped them for fantasies. Or for others even, the dream is twisted out of shape, turned into nightmares, full of power and pain, gloating and revenge and anger and fear. So where do we go for a good dream? A God dream. And the answer lies right there in the beginning of Isaiah chapter 11. The bud that shoots from the stump is not a renewed political system. It's not a scientific discovery. It's not a new invention. It is a person. It is Jesus Christ. Our hope is launched by a person. Our hope rests in Jesus, the Son of God, who will one day usher in that renewed creation, those reshaped relationships, that renewed mind. So if I can finish with a picture, simply of a three-piece suite, are you sitting in the armchair of hopelessness? If so, Jesus can give you a new dream, a new hope for the future. Ask him. Are you sitting in the armchair of fantasy? Days and hours, even years lost in futility and waste. If so, ask Jesus to give you a dream instead of a fantasy. Spend your life on something worthwhile instead of wasting it. Are you sitting, are you lying on the sofa of helplessness? If so, ask Jesus for his dream power that can change the world for the better. This prophecy of Isaiah brings us a disturbing hope. It stirs us to get out of the chair, drives us out of the door into a world to bring hope to others. A friend of mine said that they'd, in their church, they'd put a notice up on the door. As you went out, it said, "You are now entering a place of worship." Good, isn't it? It's the power of the dream, the hope that God sets in our heart, that gives us this improbable, energizing, motivating, gloriously powerful dream to change the world, to walk in the way of God, to know his presence with us. God calls us this morning out of the armchair, off the sofa, and out to serve him. Let's pray.